time, there have been a lot of laws that have been passed since 1937 that allow those forests to be managed from a multiple-use standpoint. The legislation we're looking at now by Senator Wyden would tip that balance clearly in favor of unsustainable logging at the consequence of clean water, fish and wildlife habitat, and global warming pollution.
Or why is there pressure now to log these lands more than they've been logged historically?
Well, everyone's looking for a solution to the county's fiscal crisis without really taking on the much more complex and controversial needs of the counties, which have to either increase their revenue stream or cut their services to make up for the lack of funds coming from Congress to support the federal lands that are in those counties. And so what we've been asking all along is let's continue to support those counties through through the congressional appropriations process. And in the meantime, those counties have to look for better ways to bring in revenues than clear-cutting some of the remaining mature and old-growth forests.
Well, one of the controversial aspects about Ron Wyden's Senate bill is that it incorporates a process called ecological forestry. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that there's some debate about the scientific efficacy of this. So I wanted to start by having you talk about the, I guess, the announcement that your group and several other scientific organizations made a few weeks ago denouncing the legislation and also denouncing ecological forestry. And then I want to also talk about some of the responses that you've gotten from Jerry Franklin, who's one of the co-authors of the papers about ecological forestry, to sort of sort, I want to sift out like the science behind all of this. So first of all, let's talk about why you are really concerned both about the practice of ecological forestry and how that would be applied in the Senate bill.
Well, there's nothing really new about ecological forestry. These are ideas and concepts that Dr. Franklin and others have had going back to at least the early 1990s. At the time, it was called New Perspectives Forestry, but a lot of these provisions that we're seeing are recycled concepts from that time. And, you know, it really all depends. It comes down to how you view the world. And I've taken a lot of field trips before with foresters and wildlife biologists, and we could be standing on the same plot of land, and we see things differently. A forester, you know, like Jerry Franklin, would look at a partial clear cut where you leave some of the trees in place, either in clumps or dispersed across the unit, as, you know, providing some wildlife habitat and also, you know, cutting the trees for economic purposes. But a wildlife biologist would look at that as just a modified clear cut that's not giving you that much habitat. So I think that's where the two camps differ. We're not able to pull those viewpoints together, and we unfortunately have been at odds on this. Now, if we were talking about private lands, this would be an improvement over a standard clear cut. But because there's so little mature forest left in the public ownership, that even ecological forestry would be a big step back over the current status quo management under the Northwest Forest Plan, which is protecting a lot of those mature forests that would then be subjected in practice to ecological forestry as implemented by the Bureau of Land Management.
So what are some of the distinctions between what has become common practice under the Northwest Forest Act and what would be allowed if Ron Wyden's bill actually becomes law?
Well, you know, everything moves forward in the policy arena. Back in 1993, President Clinton was looking for a politically viable alternative to the decades of timber fighting that was going on in the Northwest. And at the time, many of the scientists said that, you know, we need to be cutting a lot less than what we've been historically. But there was a compromise reached that was known as Option 9, which allows for some logging of mature forest in the so-called matrix lands. But that remains controversial. The public has moved on and is wanting the mature forest protected. The agencies are blocked every time they put up a timber sale in mature forest, but not in, you know, thinning sales in younger forest and plantations. But it seems like, you know, what is happening here is a step back in time, so that Senator Wyden is wanting to go back into those mature forests, many of them currently protected under the Northwest Forest Plan, and put them into what he's calling forestry emphasis areas. And in those forestry emphasis areas, you would see these partial clear cuts over very large landscapes that already are trying to recover from decades of clear cuts and past logging activity. So it really is not making the situation any better by going this direction.
Now, his bill would just apply to O&C lands, is that correct?
That's correct, but you know, there's also a nationwide effort that a number of senators have been talking about replicating this across all the national forests, where you would be taking some areas, setting them aside for conservation purposes, and other areas, and really increasing their logging. And you know, it sounds like a logical approach, but in the reality of the situation, when you pull back and see how little we have left on our national forest in terms of the mature forest and some of the values that they give us, it's not time to be splitting this up right now. We should have been doing this, you know, 100 years ago. We didn't, and we have very little today, so that any further splitting of the pie, if you will, is just going to be a big loss to the public.
Well, actually, I recall when I moved to Oregon in 1971, I think the horrible figure was that there was only 10% of the old growth left in the Northwest, and it's probably down to about 3% now or something like that.
Yeah, we've lost a lot of these older forests, and you know, the Pacific Northwest and the Tongass are the last of what we have on a big scale remaining on the national forest. And so if we go into those areas and we continue to log them, there's even less that's going to be available for future generations. And let me give you an example. Anybody that gets up over the region in an airplane, you know, we do this next time you're flying into Portland PDX, look out the window and you'll see just a shotgun blast of clear cuts. They really stick out in the snow. They're white background. And the green blotches that are left, most of that, particularly the old forest, are on public lands. And so any splitting of that difference, again, is just going to give you a lot more holes and a lot fewer green patches on the landscape. And so that's really what we're talking about, and that's what the fight is over.
I'm just thinking about the trip down Highway 26 a few years ago after the last big windstorm took out a lot of forests, mainly Douglas fir forests, I guess, just on the west side of the Coast Summit. And the first time I went through, I could pretty much tell which was the windfall, and well, I could tell because the trees were still on the ground, and what were the pre-existing clear cuts. A year later, you just go by and it looks like the whole area was clear cut. And in my mind, it seems like there was a connection actually between how much of that land was clear cut and then how much of it blew down. I wonder if that's one of the concerns that you raise when you're thinking, or you're concerned about expanding the clear cutting or even the partial clear cutting in the Northwest.
Yeah, I think it is. So when you have an intact forest, if you have a windstorm come through, you're going to get some blowdown along the edges. But if you fragment that forest into smaller pieces, then that blowdown becomes cumulative to the extent that what you think you're retaining for wildlife habitat doesn't really have any persistence value. And I think we're looking at that as a real concern with ecological forestry. If you're leaving a bunch of small trees in clumps or dispersed in a clear cut, those are very prone to blow down, to insect infestations, and even fire hazards, because a lot of the slash is left on the ground. That could be the next severe wildfire that comes through the area that's not characteristic in terms of the burns that we get, because we leave so many slash piles in these clear cuts, then the next time a fire comes through, they have a tendency to blow up.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's chief scientist with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, and we're talking about a proposed bill that Ron Wyden is putting forward to increase, actually double logging on what's called the Oregon-California lands that are run by the BLM. And we're talking about some concerns that a number of scientists have about increasing logging on these lands and what kind of precedent this might set for more widespread logging across the national forest in the United States. Well, Dominic, I wanted to kind of break down some of the definitions about types of forest, classes of forest. I think most everybody who's listening is familiar with the term old growth forest, but then there's all these other descriptions. I mean, you talk about mature forest, this late succession forest, and how does this, how are these divisions defined, and why are they all necessary in order to have a healthy forest ecosystem?
Yeah, great question. So in our region, you know, if you're out on a day hike and you're walking through a forest, if you're in a plantation, you're in a stand of trees that has densely packed small trees, usually only one or two conifer species being managed for, you know, as a tree farm. Everybody knows what that looks like. I'm sure your listeners have hiked through those areas. And then if you, on your hike, pop out into an old-growth forest, there's a big difference visually and in terms of the wildlife that are in those forests. The old-growth forest in our region, especially in the wet forest, have lots of different tree species in them, big old trees, some of which are dead or dying, and that's incredibly important wildlife habitat. You've got species like woodpeckers, owls, all kinds of mammals that, and bats that use those dead trees and are part of the, you know, web of life in those older forests. And that's what the fight is about, because there's so little of that left. And, you know, kind of because we have eliminated almost all our old-growth forests, what we want to be looking at is restoration. And so we want to be increasing the older forest over time. And even if we protect all the old growth, we still would like to see the younger forest becoming mature over time. So a mature forest is a forest that doesn't have all the characteristics of old growth, but if you give it another couple of decades, then that forest will become old growth as it ages. And unfortunately, the Wyden Bill is subjecting over 100,000 acres of the mature forest on the wet side to the kinds of forestry that we've been talking about. So you really wouldn't get that next stage of forests that are almost old growth becoming old growth so that you can recover the ecosystem that has been lost.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about getting older and having lived in Oregon for quite a long time now, I've actually seen forests be really transform themselves in the last 40 years. And I'm thinking about this hike, one of my favorite hikes in Mount Hood, the Vista Ridge Trail, and how when I first went on that hike in the early 70s, it was you had great clear views of the mountains. It was a pretty open landscape. And then over the next 30 years, the trees filled in and it became a really dense Douglas fir forest. And then 3 years ago, there was a big fire up there and it took out most of those Douglas firs that obscured the view from the Vista Ridge Trail. And the last time I was up there, the view was very similar to what I remember in like 1972 or 73. So it seemed like fire was playing the role that loggers would like to play. And there's two kind of ironies that I see, that if that area wasn't wilderness, that area probably would have been logged. And then the other one that was interesting was when you went into the burn the year after the fire, there were signs all over saying this is a wilderness area, no logging. Because there's still, I guess, some sense people have that once there's a fire, the best thing to do is to go in and grab the logs. But there's I saw an article in the Oregonian over the weekend about somebody, I think he's some state legislature in Oregon, who is complaining about all the wasted wood and how he wants to increase logging. One of the places he wants to increase logging is in burn areas. And one of the burn areas he's focusing on is the Biscuit Fire. So I wonder, how do we kind of balance these viewpoints? And what do you see as... Well, how would you counter somebody who would be saying that this wood is going to waste if all it's going to do is ultimately burn?
Yeah, you know, it comes back to how you see the world. And, you know, a forester might look at that as a waste. We need to get in there and salvage log those areas and then replant with conifers. And a wildlife biologist would look at it and say, wow, that burn really produced some enriched habitat for all kinds of fire-dependent species. So, you know, the way I like to look at this, using the analogy of a relay race. So you've got all these people lined up and running around this track, and your young forest then hands the baton to the mature forest, then hands the baton to the old growth forest as it ages around the track, if you will. And so if you break that relay race anywhere along the race, you're not going to have a complete race with all the players involved. And that's essentially what happens when you salvage log an area that's been burned. A fire will give you habitat for wildlife. You get those big snags that are left that a lot of critters depend on. And those snags then go through the relay race over time. The forests come back with the snags present, those dead trees. And, you know, in about 100 years, you've got an old-growth forest. But if you go in there and you log those big old trees that have been burned, you break that relay race so that that forest doesn't go through the process of becoming old growth, and you've eliminated that habitat that's essential for fire-dependent species. So that kind of logging does not mimic the natural disturbances that we see in nature. You know, nature really knows best when it comes to disturbances, and the kind of logging that we do during a disturbance like a fire is not going to give you the complete relay race.
Well, is there a way to do logging that would better mimic natural disturbances?
I think there is, although I question whether or not we have any good examples anywhere in the world on an industrial scale. I think we could do it on a small scale, but if you start to look at the kinds of industrial logging activities that it's really corporate logging that is happening on the national forest, the scale of that those activities in combination with the scale of logging on private lands is not sustainable, and we're not mimicking the natural disturbance processes like a wildfire would.
Well, I keep coming back to the same kind of issue, whether we're talking about natural resources extraction being forests or being extracting oil or bitumen or whatever we're doing to ravage the earth. But there's this argument that keeps coming up, well, we need the resources. So how do we is there a way for us to live sustainably through logging the forests, or do we really have to really rethink how much we take from the forests at this point?
Yeah, I think both of those. I think we definitely need to rethink things, and especially in the context of climate change. You know, we have a very narrow perspective on the values and the benefits that we're getting from these forests. Most of our benefits we're getting that we aren't attaching any economic value to, but they're essential for quality of life in our region. Just to give you an example, if you take a look at the 100,000-plus mature forests that are scheduled or would be scheduled for logging in the Wyden Bill, if you run the numbers on those forests in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide that would be released if you log those forests over the 20-year period that's in the Senator Wyden's bill, the emissions coming from that logging over that period of time would be equivalent to the dirtiest coal-fired power plant in the state of Oregon. So we're devaluing the benefits that we're getting from those forests by just looking at one part of the equation, the economic return from 2x4s, and not looking at what this means in terms of the water quality, the carbon that's being pulled out of the atmosphere, the fish and wildlife habitat. Typically what we see when you actually sum up those benefits, they exceed the narrow benefit of, you know, just to getting a timber product out of those forests.
So if we were, how do we continue to find a way to for the timber-dependent counties in Oregon to find some kind of source of funding themselves? And at the same time, how do we manage to have enough wood that we need for to build civilization as we know
it? Well, let me answer the last part of that, and then I'll go back to the first part of it. The last part in terms of what do we do about our forest need? We need fiber. There's no question about it. And we need to also reduce our incredible consumption levels, wasteful consumption in particular, using what we have and reusing it and growing our fiber needs on the existing plantations, and also looking for alternatives to wood fiber. There's all kinds of different alternatives that are out there that could be tapped into. Now, in terms of the counties, to call them timber-dependent, clearly there are communities that are still timber-dependent, but by and large, if you look at a lot of the information that's come out since the Northwest Forest Plan, a lot of the counties have moved beyond single extraction resource economies. The ones that are in best shape have diversified economies, not single extraction economies. I think that's the message in this, is that if a county is going to have a robust economy, moving into diversified economic streams is the way to go, particularly along the I-5 corridor. The other thing that's really interesting in this is, oh, back about a decade ago, my organization sponsored an economic study of how the amount of protection the protected areas, that each of these counties are the magnet for bringing in new businesses to those regions to help diversify their economies. That is to say, the higher the degree of protection at the county level, the more diversified and robust those local economies were, and they were able to withstand the downcline or the downward trend of timber extraction in those same communities.
Well, one concern I would have, like Coos County, which is long gone as a timber county, but now they are building an LNG plant there. And there's also talk about having some of these counties be the homes for coal terminals, coal train terminals, or oil train terminals. So we might not be extracting timber from the lands anymore, and the counties might not be dependent on timber receipts. But I'm not sure that some of the alternatives are any better, or maybe are even worse than logging.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think by and large you want to have a diversified economy, but if all you're doing is moving from one extraction to another extraction, you really haven't solved the problem. You're just chasing smokestacks, and you know that's not good for either the ecology or the economy in the long run. So we've got to find other ways that are more in balance with what is a livable planet, if we're going to continue to have some sort of sustainable society.
Well, another option that's often thrown out is tourism. I was just up in British Columbia last week talking with people about the proposed pipeline to pipe bitumen from the tar sands over to Burnaby, British Columbia, and a lot of upset and protest about it. And one of the big arguments against it is that one of the largest industries in British Columbia is tourism, and this would really make a big dent in tourism dollars. And this, I feel a little bit of unease thinking that we're going to replace what used to be high-paying mill jobs and forest jobs and other resource extraction jobs with much lower-paying tourism jobs, and also that tourism itself has a kind of a spreading and bizarre footprint on the planet. So I wonder, is tourism in your bag of tricks, or are you thinking that that's also a possibly not a great alternative?
Well, everything has limits in nature, but I think if you're looking at ways to get people more involved with protecting their landscape, we've got to show them that there's a way that they also can make a living in doing that. And it's real interesting, if you look at not only BC, but if you pull back and look at Alaska, one out of every 10 jobs in Alaska is associated with ecotourism and the commercial fishing industry and recreation fishing. And you come here in Oregon, about 12% of the region's economy is tourism driven. So it's happening. Whether or not it's sustainable is another question. You've got these huge cruise ships that go through the Inside Passage, and there are pluses and minuses associated with that. I just think, you know, it's a big global problem that we have in terms of there's a lot of people on this planet consuming a lot of resources, and, you know, nature has limits. It's kind of the whole basis of your show. This is a planet in peril, and we just have to figure out a way that reduces our footprint so that there are still old-growth forests and still, you know, wild salmon runs for future generations. We're not on that path right now, but we've got to figure out how to get there really soon.
Well, this morning we're talking with Dominic Della Sala, who's chief scientist with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, and we're discussing some of the problems with the proposed bill that Senator Ron Wyden has introduced that would drastically increase logging on the so-called Oregon and California lands that are lands in western Oregon counties that have been historically dependent on timber receipts to pay their bills. I'd like to talk a little bit about Jerry Franklin, who I talked with several years ago when I was doing, it's about the same time I met you, Dominic, and I was doing a project about the Biscuit Fire. And he was talking about the Northwest Forest Plan. And I think he and you, this is back in the early 21st century, we're pretty much in agreement about a lot of stuff, though obviously you come from different perspectives. I wonder how much Jerry Franklin's perspectives have changed, or because he's even quoted, you cite him in your paper about the problems with ecological forestry, and you cite some of his findings as arguments against this plan that he's now proposing, though it sounds like this is something he's been working on for a long time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Jerry and I have co-authored a number of papers over the years, and I have a lot of respect for Jerry. He's a brilliant scientist. And I just think that, you know, he was asked to solve for a political issue. And instead of solving for what is best for the forest in the long run. I think you try to blend a political solution with a scientific solution, and in doing so, he took some risks. And the risk that he took in his approach, I think, is what is being challenged or questioned by scientists, not just me, but two of the nation's leading scientific societies that work on fish and wildlife have raised concerns about it. Other scientific societies, such as the Wildlife Society, have raised concerns about it, and it's just unfortunate that we're not able to resolve this. And typically what happens when you get a dispute in a scientific community, you work it out through testing the uncertainties by doing experiments. So instead of doing that, those uncertainties were bypassed in favor of setting up a couple of pilots on BLM land in Western Oregon, and those pilots also have some of the same problems that are being raised by the scientific societies, that they're going into mature forests, taking out the big trees, and that's just not going to work for species that depend on that. And this is herein where we are with the controversy.
Well, in the critique that he wrote of an article that you wrote criticizing ecological forestry, he basically seemed to be saying that, particularly when you're making distinctions between dry forests and wet forests and some of the other issues raised, that he wasn't as black and white as you are depicting him as being, and that he sees the complexity the same way that you do. So do you see that he has a more complex vision of what's going on than the way you depict it in your paper, or do you think that he is really oversimplifying forest ecology in order to make this plan workable?
You know, I think in Jerry's defense, he's trying to do what he thinks is a solution to decades of controversy over BLM ONC lands. And, you know, he's going to push the envelope a lot further than I feel comfortable and a lot of other scientists feel comfortable on this. And I think the other part of this issue is, how is ecological forestry being implemented on the ground by the federal agencies, particularly the BLM? And the BLM, I think, has taken certain liberties beyond what Jerry Franklin has written in his articles. And if you look at the paper that I published, it wasn't only a criticism of the ecological provisions or ecological forestry that Jerry has put forth, but how the BLM is interpreting it on the ground and how Fish and Wildlife Service is treating it during consultation under the Endangered Species Act.
Now, is Jerry Franklin at all reinserting himself into the process and saying to these guys, hey, this isn't what I had in mind, you're kind of abusing my premises?
I don't know. I think it would be good for you to have him on the show next time.
As I was reading the thing that you sent me this morning, I thought, yes, I should have Jerry back on. Because I really would love to talk to him about it, because my interview with him a number of years ago was really a fascinating interview, and he really struck me as, he seemed to be very pointed in his criticisms of the kind of logging status quo that there was back in the early part of this decade, and also very, very critical of salvage logging. So I didn't know enough about his background to see that, you know, the distinction between being a forester and being a wildlife biologist, and how much difference that makes in the way that you see the forest. But I will definitely have him on. I think that's a very good point. Well, what are the next steps? I mean, are people raising their voices very loudly to try to stop this Wyden bill from happening? What's going on the ground?
Yeah, I think so. There's been a lot of opposition on both sides, actually. It's not just the conservation community and scientists that are concerned about this. I think that if you talk to the timber industry, they've been saying that there's not enough logs that they're getting from this bill. And so I think what we're going to see over the coming months is, if Senator Wyden goes to move his bill through the legislative process, there's going to be an increase in the amount of opposition and controversy around it. There already is a bunch of work that's going on by conservation groups that are orchestrating rallies to help folks realize what's at stake. And there'll be additional work from the scientific community to get this information out to members of Congress. I worked with two of the nation's scientific societies, the Society for Conservation Biology and the American Fisheries Society, in submitting testimony to the Senate hearing. And we'll be making sure that members of Congress get that testimony, including the Obama administration, as we raise these concerns.
Well, do you know how much support the rest of the Oregon delegation is giving to Wyden's bill?
I'm not really sure. I think it would be good for you to talk to Senator Merkley. They have said that they want a solution to the ONC issue, but it's not clear whether or not they would raise the kinds of concerns that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that Merkley, Blumenauer, and Bonamici are probably the three hopes. The rest of the delegation, I can't imagine. I think some of them might actually be calling for more logging than what Ron Wyden's calling for. Having this memory, years ago, I was doing a lot of lobbying for public radio in Washington, and so I would meet with Ron Wyden's chief of staff every year to lobby for public radio. And one year when I was talking with her, I mentioned something which made her think I was going to be lobbying about logging, and she really bristled. And I said, no, we're talking about public radio. But I thought that was interesting, and it's one of those things that makes me uneasy about how much Ron Wyden gets the real issues about logging and how much he's kind of fallen into that old traditional Washington-Oregon syndrome of politicians where you think that you have to be supportive of some kind of you have to be supportive of the timber industry in order to stay elected, which I thought was changing considering the landscape of a lot of our politicians now. But I'm wondering if that is where you see that Ron Wyden still fits into that old mold of Pacific Northwest politicians.
Yeah, I think so. And it's unfortunate because a lot of the other parts of the region have moved on. I mean, you don't have these controversies nearly as much in the state of Washington or state of California. A lot of the timber industry has moved on, realizing that they had to upgrade their facilities to take smaller logs.
They've also moved out of the state, some of them, like Maxim.
Yeah, so a lot of folks have moved on this. It just seems like Oregon is ground zero for what remains over the timber wars in this region, unfortunately.
So I wanted to talk about some of the other concerns that where you and Jerry Franklin are seeing things differently. And one is the impact of climate change, because he claims that your paper doesn't take enough consideration of climate change, if it doesn't factor it in. And it seems like you're saying that they're not factoring in climate change. So how do you see the issues of climate change impacting the kind of scenario you'd like to see put forward and the scenario that you see in ecological forestry?
I think where Jerry and I differ is that Jerry probably sees projections for increased fire in our region as a big problem for carbon dioxide emissions. And I see the increased logging in our region as a bigger concern for increased carbon dioxide emissions. And where the science comes in on this is the studies that have been done shown that the logging footprint in our region by far would exceed the carbon dioxide emissions from a forest fire. And so I think what we need to do is recognize that fires are an important part of nature. We could prepare at the community level in the wildland urban interface and become firewise communities to protect our assets, but forests are going to burn. And they're going to emit carbon dioxide when they burn, and they're also going to sequester carbon as they come back over time. But when you have a logging operation, you're removing a lot more carbon from those forests. You're releasing it as carbon dioxide, and you don't get that carbon stored in the original unlogged forest because a lot of it goes up into the atmosphere and fossil fuels are used to manufacture and transport the wood products. So that's where I think Jerry and I are different. He's focused mostly on the fire side. I'm focused mostly on the logging side. And, you know, hopefully there's a way to meet in the middle on that.
Maybe you guys can have a good conversation sometime about this. Maybe I should have you both on together. That might be interesting.
That would be
good. Well, one last thing, you also talk about the concern about building permanent roads. And it seems to me that over the last 20 years, there's been a big emphasis on decommissioning roads in the national forests. So what is the issue with roads, and how would Wyden's bill exacerbate the problem?
Well, the Wyden's bill would allow for temporary roads, and the temporary roads are, if not worse than permanent roads, they're almost as bad. It just kind of depends on the situation, and they're typically a temporary road is not engineered to the same kinds of standards that you get a permanent road, so you're going to get a lot more sediment It's unclear when those roads would be taken out after the logging operation. They're costly to take out. You need a lot of roads to do thinning because you need to have access. And so those are some additional concerns that feed back into water quality issues. And I think any time you get a proposal on the table to do more logging, you need more roads, and you're going to have more sediment problems, and that causes water quality and fisheries issues.
Well, I can still visualize some of my favorite hikes where they've taken out roads and it's been 10, 15 years and you still know you're hiking on a road for the first mile of that hike. So I think anybody who goes out in the woods can see the issues, that the long-term scarring of roads.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe the upside of this is that this might be a way where we can actually meet on issues of restoration that involve, you know, jobs in the woods, people putting the pieces back into the forest that were taken out. By that I mean, there are certainly places where we've got too many roads, too many failing roads. Those roads could be decommissioned. There are jobs in that, and there are all kinds of jobs in thinning overstocked plantations that I think would have a restoration focus and something that we could support.
Well, Dominic, it's always great talking with you, and so I will see if we can set up a conversation between you and Jerry Franklin sometime in the next couple months.
So sounds good. Thanks for having me on again, Barbara.
Okay, thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's chief scientist with Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with David Hasemeyer, who's co-author of a new report by Inside Climate News, the Center for Public Integrity, and the Weather Channel, called Fracking the Eagle Ford Shale, Big Oil and Bad Air on the Texas Prairie. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening.
It's more than rain that falls on our parade tonight. It's more than thunder, and it's more than a bad dream. Now that I'm sober, nothing but sad times. Nothing but sad times. None of our pockets are lined with gold. Caught the bouquet.
Recently, the Portia Project hosted the Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School. Speakers covered many issues women face in prison and ideas for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline, February 24th at 6:30 p.m.
And it's 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming up next, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness. The topic is living with multiple sclerosis. And at 11:30, the focus is the Mount Hood Community College Creative Writing Speaker Series, which brings authors, poets, filmmakers, and scholars to the MHCC campus for a series of interdisciplinary readings and discussions. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.
Hi, this is Grace Eagle Reed, and I'm with Disability Awareness. Thank you, KABU, for giving me a voice and a mic today. Very important stuff coming at us today. First, I want to do is Marianne ready? We have a call-in from Marianne Stupa Wallace, or we're calling her. She just lost her 15-year-old nephew to Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. And, okay, so we'll talk to Marianne when she gets ready to come to the phone. Anyway, so I have multiple sclerosis, so it's all about me. When I'm at this mic, I have a friend with me today, she will be making an announcement towards the end of the show. On her project, but she also drives me over here, and she's handicapped, and it's really quite funny how we try to load my little walker into her car. Yes, anyway, funny if it were funny. I want to start with policy definitions of, and I'm leading to something here, policy and procedures and mission statements. And policy and procedure, I want to do a definition on both, and then I want to address three distinct situations that happened this week to me personally and to some of my friends who are handicapped and disabled. And I want you to understand, which I think you will just by my definition, of how many really sad and stressful things that are coming at us literally all at once. Policy and procedures. It's a set of, and I'm stating the obvious, a set of policies and principles, rules and guidelines formulated or adopted by an organization to reach its long-term goals and typically, it's designed to influence and determine all major decisions and actions and all activities within company goals. And a mission statement is a statement of the purpose of a company, an organization, or a person, its reason to exist. It determines the goals, the paths, the guides, the decision-making. It is the framework for strategies. Yeah, is Marianne on yet?
I'm here. Hello?
Hi, Marianne.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, turn your radio down if you have a radio on, hon.
I don't have a radio on.
Okay, and Marianne, I want I just thank you for calling in, or we called you, I guess, but I really wanted to offer condolences to the loss of your 15-year-old nephew who died of Duchenne's muscular dystrophy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, it was a very unexpected, yet not surprising death.
He died suddenly, though, didn't he?
He did. He died suddenly in his home on Friday, February 7th. As my sister describes it, he was alive and talking to her at 5:30. At 6 p.m., he was pronounced dead.
Yeah. And and I'm so sorry, Marianne. I know that was hard on everybody, and it still is, and all of that. And I know we've talked about it, you know, before this call.
Yeah.
So, and you have, you are handicapped, you are hearing impaired?
Right, yeah, it's a hearing loss in both ears, yeah.
And then, may I talk about your brother Joe? He has Duchenne muscular dystrophy as well.
Yes, he does.
And how old is he?
He is 56 years old.
And that is a miracle for muscular Duchenne. So I wanted
Actually, I found out, for the record, there are only two people who live to the age of 70 with Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, as far as I know, there's only one other person that's in his 50s.
Wow.